Good morning, and thanks for coming to another in our series on medical halacha. Topic for this morning is treating diabetes on Shabbos, and I've been ducking this topic for a couple of years now because it involves so many different elements, but finally bit the bullet and said, okay, let's see what's going on. And in order to prepare this, I had the help of quite a few people. I want to single out endocrinologist Dr. Kusiel Perlman for his help in educating me on the nature of diabetes, its origin and various elements of it, as well as several people who I'm not sure if they want to be named or not, so I'll leave them nameless at the moment, but people who deal with diabetes themselves personally. I also want to mention two particular websites that I found very helpful, which are in source number one. The first being friendswithdiabetes.org, which is excellent. The information on it is a little bit dated in that they haven't updated the site in what looks like about 10 years. But in terms of what they do have on there, there's a wealth of information on living with diabetes in different times during the Jewish calendar year. So they talk about Tu B'Shvat and the different carb counts and sugar counts for different kinds of fruit, and they talk obviously about the Seder and about issues of fasting and about the apple and honey on Rosh Hashanah. They talk about different types of meters, which again will be a little out of date because the information is older, but also very worthwhile. I found their information very helpful. They also have diabetes jokes. I didn't even know those existed. But in their publications, they actually have diabetes-related jokes. I can tell them to you afterwards. And then the other one is jewishdiabetes.com, which also is an extremely helpful website, I found. The other two links that I have for you in source number one are links related to fasting, because many people ask me in the run-up to the shiur, they ask me for information about fasting, whether I would discuss fasting, but there's so much to discuss that's Shabbos-related that I'm just not going to get to fasting as a topic today. But those two links provide in-depth discussion on the topic of fasting when one has diabetes, obviously, and I'm going to say this repeatedly throughout the shiur. We do everything we need to do in order to save lives, without question. And we do not endanger ourselves for the sake of either fasting or Shabbos observance. The answer to the question of should I fast or not is first you should not, and then let's see if there's a way that you can. But the default assumption is not to. If somebody is dealing with diabetes, we view this as a pikuach nefesh, a life-saving situation. So I want to make sure that we're very clear about that, and that's going to be repeated in a variety of ways throughout the shiur. What I'm providing here is not psak. This is not, I'm not providing halachic statements of do this, don't do that. What I'm providing is a discussion of the issues at hand for you to then, you know, take and discuss with your rabbi. This really should not be viewed as final word on anything. I did take the step, if you flip your sheets to the last page, I took the step of compiling suggestions that you should discuss with your doctor and rabbi. Because I want to make sure that the results of my comments this morning are clear, and hopefully this will help. Okay, final word of preparation. I want to thank Bayit Adult Education for making this possible. Okay, background on diabetes in general. And I apologize for the fact that many of you are probably more familiar than I am with the nature of diabetes, but just to make sure we're all on the same page, and please update me, correct me if my information is not correct. In a healthy situation, the body takes in food. The food is broken down into amino acids, fatty acids, and simple sugars. The pancreas releases insulin, a protein, telling the body's cells to accept sugar from the bloodstream, providing energy. Right? That's a normal, healthy situation. Okay, you take it in, you digest it, you get sugar into the bloodstream, and the insulin is going to help the body to absorb the sugar. Diabetes comes in two basic types. In type 1 diabetes, the body's autoimmune system attacks the pancreas, which then diminishes insulin production. There may also be some insulin resistance within the body as well. It tends to be genetic, although I'm told with an environmental trigger. That's the type 1 diabetes. And the treatment for that, since the body is not producing enough insulin, the treatment is to add insulin by injection. You can't take insulin as a pill, as I understand it, because it's a protein, and therefore it'll be digested within the body, and that won't work. So that's type 1. Type 2, the body resists the effect of insulin. It's not sensitive to the insulin. There may also be some damage to the pancreas as well, but the treatment for it is to alter the body's sensitivity to insulin or to stimulate further insulin production, and if both fail, then the person will need insulin injections. That's type 2. Are we're okay with these definitions? Okay. The results of leaving the acceptable range of blood sugar, if you're not producing the insulin, or the body is not sensitive to the insulin that's there. So there are two direct results that are possible. One, if there isn't enough insulin circulating, the body will develop hyperglycemia. There will be too much sugar in the bloodstream. It's not getting into the body. The body isn't getting the sugar that it needs. And one result of that is that the body will begin to break down fats for energy, and that produces something called ketones, which the body cannot tolerate and can lead to ketoacidosis, also known as diabetic coma, which is life-threatening. That's one possibility. At the other end of the spectrum, if the body has too much insulin, such as where an injection was, an injection of insulin was too much, or the treatment of the pancreas was too strong, a person can end up with hypoglycemia, also known as insulin shock. There are other elements that can drive down blood sugar. Exercise can drive down blood sugar. Alcohol can drive down blood sugar. Alcohol does it by inhibiting the liver's release of stored glucose. But the result of that can be seizure or coma, and that is also life threatening. Those are the direct results, potentially, either hypoglycemia, too little blood sugar, or hyperglycemia, too much blood sugar. And either way, the results are potentially life-threatening. There are also indirect problems, long-term problems associated with swings in blood sugar, damage to one's eyes, kidneys, heart, brain, and nervous system. So people who have diabetes need to test their blood sugar level in order to ensure that it's within an acceptable range. There are tests that one may take before meals to ensure that food intake is not going to take the patient out of range, or to make sure to be able to give a proper dose of insulin to help digest the food. But there also are tests that are done at other times to ensure that one is not leaving the appropriate range of blood sugar. One's ability to skip such a test depends on the track record that they have on their tests, as well as, if you're going to talk about Shabbos, the possibility that the Shabbos diet is going to throw off a person's blood sugar in general. They may be perfectly stable Sunday through Friday, but throw chillin' at them and watch what happens. Or grape juice, or wine, or a whole dose, a whole bunch of other foods. Challah as well. So the current technology for tests, as I understand it, is that one draws blood, generally by lancing a finger. You put the blood on a strip. The strip is inserted into a machine that detects a chemical reaction with blood sugar. And there are also now all-in-one lancers / testers. You put your finger in it and it'll do the rest. There are also continuous glucose monitoring devices. These take readings every X number of minutes, like 5 minutes is what I've seen, via subcutaneous needle that's actually not using blood. It's using fluid that's under the skin, interstitial, if that's the proper pronunciation, interstitial fluid. Some of these can actually be good for up to 7 days, where you simply have this thing and you don't have to worry about it. It does need calibration, though. I'm told 2 to 4 times a day. Experts here, is that right? It needs calibration 2 to 4 times a day with a finger prick in order to ensure that it's not off. It's also, from what I understand from people who use them, it's generally considered reliable in broad terms, but users report an interesting problem. The blood sugar is going to run ahead. Well, the blood sugar in the blood is going to run ahead of the blood sugar that you're going to detect in the interstitial fluid. Meaning that if there's a dramatic change, the glucose monitoring machine that's using the interstitial fluid is not going to pick up on it immediately. It's going to lag behind what's going on in one's blood. And that can be a real problem. There are also methods being tested for non-invasive testing, but they're not yet considered available and reliable. I saw all sorts of interesting things, radio frequencies, electromagnetic resonance, lasers through the skin. Google is testing a contact lens that's going to test blood sugar through tears, all sorts of different ideas. But as of now, nothing that's actually out there on the market. And anybody wanting to switch and say, well, if I can, let's say, use a contact lens, it'll be better than lancing myself on Shabbos, the answer is not until you know that this is actually going to work and work well. But that's in terms of the testing. And then what does one do? Let's say one discovers that one's blood sugar is too high. So for type 1 diabetics, they inject insulin, which will be via syringe or a needle requiring assembly or a pump. There is a battery-driven pump with an IV catheter. It can stay in for days at a time, and it has the ability of being able to time insulin, has the advantage of being able to time insulin injection and to space it out over time. I saw actually this really neat discussion in, I think it was in the Friends with Diabetes website. They're talking about the problem of cholent and its effect on your blood sugar, because they noted that because of the fibers and fats in the cholent, the sugar will take a long time to be absorbed into the bloodstream. And so they recommend for people with a pump to do different things with their bolus to be able to absorb the blood sugar from it, to counter it, I should say, with insulin over time. But that's for type 1s, is to inject insulin. For type 2s, they'll take pills that will stimulate the pancreas or alter the body's insulin sensitivity. That's if you have too much blood sugar. If your blood sugar is too low, then you eat sugar or simple carbohydrates. In a drastic case, one would inject glucagon to stimulate the liver to release glucose. That's a basic overview. Are we good with the basic facts that we're talking about? Yeah? Okay. So we have to address the following areas then. Number one, a general discussion of dealing with pikuach nefesh, life-saving on Shabbos, safek pikuach nefesh, what about if I'm not sure whether an action is needed to save lives, a situation that could become pikuach nefesh if left untreated, and that realm. That's the first area that we need to deal with. The second area we need to deal with is the question of how you test on Shabbos, use of, lancing one's finger, use of the strips, and so on. Third, we have to deal with delivering insulin into the body and issues of injections, as well as the issue of taking pills for type 2 diabetes. Then the issue of delivering sugar into one's blood if one is hypoglycemic, and we'll discuss what that means. And then finally, some concerns that relate to Shabbos meals. So there's an awful lot to discuss. And whereas normally we try to deal with a lot of the background and primary sources, dealing with this topic, we're going to be focused primarily on the practical, because there's just so much that is very practical here. As always, please interrupt me with questions, comments, and tomatoes. Okay. So, the first point someone actually mentioned to me in an email leading up to this year was to discuss the importance of following sound medical advice. So, that one we covered. We had a shiur on this topic back in October, November. So, I'm not going to spend the next hour on that, other than to tell you it's on yutorah.org as well as on koshutube.com. But it is, one of the points that emerged, if not the main point that emerged from that shiur, is that we are halachically obligated to listen to our doctors. And when the doctor says to you, this is dangerous, we don't play games, and we certainly are absolutely prohibited from saying, well, I want to be firmer than the doctor's advice. That is discussed explicitly in the Shulchan Aruch, and one is not entitled to say, well, I want to be strict. That is simply not allowed. So that's something that we stipulate at the outset. We know that saving lives overrides Shabbos. In addition to that, saving lives in a case of doubt, where I'm not sure that it's necessary, also override Shabbos. If you take a look at your sheets, and for those who don't have a source sheet, I know Elaine's been giving them out, thank you very much. If you take a look at source number 2, first of all, you find a key line in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, Misha Yeshlo Choli Shal Sakana Mitzvah Lachal Alavas HaShabbos. If somebody is dangerously ill, it is a mitzvah to violate Shabbos for them. Your mitzvah is to violate Shabbos. Your mitzvah is not to observe it, your mitzvah is to violate it. V'hazariz hareza mishubach. One who is energetic is praised. V'hashoel. And if someone consults and says, well, gee, should I? Hare ze shofech damim. That's called shedding blood. You don't ask questions, do not pass go, etc. You simply do. What about if you're not sure? Take a look at source number 3, please. This is a Mishnah in Yoma. They're discussing Yom Kippur there primarily, but it enters the discussion about Shabbos as well. HaChoshesh bigrono. If someone has some kind of a sore throat, there are other additions which have bepeh, or in parts of the mouth, a person has pain in one's mouth. Matilin lo sam besoch piv b'Shabbos. So we put medicine into his mouth on Shabbos. Mipneshu safek nefashos, because this is potentially dangerous to life. V'chol safek nefashos docha es haShabbos. And that overrides Shabbos, even safek. Any doubt in a matter of life and death overrides Shabbos. And that is quoted as halacha in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 4 and source number 5. The Shulchan Aruch in source number 4 writes about a non-internal wound. The Shulchan Aruch distinguishes between internal wounds and non-internal wounds, because something that is internal is considered to be in doubt automatically. The doctors aren't able to tell you for sure what's going on inside the person. Now, obviously, that changes with various technologies over time. Separate discussion. But when the Shulchan Aruch writes, Maka she'ena shel chalal, a wound that is not internal. In other words, it's on the surface, and therefore anybody can see what's going on. Nishalin bebakiu bechola. So we ask the expert, and we also ask the patient. And that's its own discussion of what if the doctor says you don't need, but the patient says, yes, I do. And the rule is you follow what the patient says then. Ve'ein mechalin olav Shabbos. You don't violate Shabbos. Ad sheyomer echad mehem shu tzarach lechilul, until one of them says you need to. O sheyasa etzel echad mehem sakanas nefashos. Or if one of them views it as a danger to life. Now that line in the Shulchan Aruch is very difficult to understand, right? Because the line says you don't violate Shabbos unless one of them says you need it, or one of them thinks this is dangerous. Those are the same thing. So the Mishnah Berurah explains that we have a typo in our edition of the Shulchan Aruch. Source number 5, he says, no, Tzarech Lomar Safek Sakanas Nefashos. What it should say is, in those last words in source number 4, if one of them views it as a possible danger to life, Rotza Lomar, De'afilu Omim Rak Shema Yichbad Olav Acholi V'yistakei Nami Shari. Even if the doctor or the patient simply says, maybe this is going to get worse, and then he will be in danger, that is sufficient to warrant violating Shabbos. And he notes that's why the Ramah, Ramosha Isserlis, the Ashkenazi gloss to the Shulchan Aruch, says, see the laws of eating on Yom Kippur, because the rule is the same over there when one is in doubt. So the rule is we violate Shabbos not only for saving a life where there is known danger, but also where there might be danger, and even in a situation in which there is no danger right now, but if left untreated, it could become dangerous over the course of Shabbos. So in other words, you have the diabetic who says, you know, it's now, let's make this up now, it's 4 in the afternoon, and Shabbos is going to be over at 7. Well, you know what? Let me push off this test, because right now I'm fine. And realistically, I will need a test later on, but yeah, maybe I can push it off and see, and it'll go a little bit later. The rule is that if it could become life-threatening at any point during Shabbos, you take care of it now. This is Siyah Nigmar in Ksuvos Da Samach. I didn't bring it on your sheet, where they discuss the case of somebody an adult who needs to nurse on Shabbos because of an illness. And tied into that, if you take a look at source number 6, the Shulchan Aruch writes the following: Kishiyodim umakirim ba'oso choli shemamtin ve'ein tzarech lechilul. When you know that a particular illness could wait, and desecration of Shabbos is not needed, then asur lechalal olav. Then you're not allowed to violate Shabbos for that person. But only if you know that it can wait. If you don't know for sure that it can wait, then you're not entitled to say, well, I would like to wait. And the Mishnah Berurah says this explicitly in source number 7. He says, Rod Salomer Shemakirim Biveirur, Shalo Yisgaber Hacholi Yoser, Al Yedei Shenamtin Ad Halayla B'motzai Shabbos. Meaning, you have to know clearly it's not going to get worse by waiting until Shabbos is over. That's the requirement. And so the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, in source number 8, writes regarding surgeries. He's not dealing with diabetes in this particular context, but he talks about surgery, and he says you would delay the surgery only if there is no concern that one's situation could worsen and he could enter danger, and all the more so if you're dealing with something that is volatile. Like when you're talking about diabetes, for some, not for every diabetic, but for many diabetics, blood sugar can actually change abruptly. And so he writes in source number 9, Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham writes there as well. The Hebrew is on one side of the page, the English is over on the other side. Amar li Agon Shlomo Zalman Orbach Zatzal, Shebechol Mikra Shehu Shal Machala Harifa Mesukenes Shenivhalim Alav Biyom Chol. He says, anytime you're dealing with a machala that is harif, harif here does not mean something you put on your falafel, but rather it is something that is volatile. It can change abruptly. Something which, if this was a weekday, you would say, let's act right now. Right? You are obligated to do this immediately and not to wait. And he says, even if during the week it could be that if there was a more urgent surgery, they would say, well, we have to do this now, and therefore they'll wait a little bit. If that's the only reason why it's going to get delayed, that's not a reason to delay it on Shabbos. He says you would do it immediately. So he writes in source number 9. The diabetic, to take the turn for diabetic now, the diabetic's instability is considered to be a case of chole sheyesh bo sakana, is considered to be a case in which one is indeed dangerously ill. That's obvious when someone is hyperglycemic or hypoglycemic, as we outlined in the beginning of the shiur. But even when he's doing fine and just needs insulin to prevent instability, we will say this. If you take a look at source number 10, it's an explicit statement from Rabbi Dr. Avraham Sofer Abraham in his Nishmas Avram. He writes, Uklulim bahagdara zu, included in this category, and I added in brackets, of dangerously ill patients, included in the category of chole sheyesh bo sakana, is chole shelafidas harofe yesh sakana au afilu safek sakana lechayav, a patient who the doctor believes is in danger or might be in danger. Or his illness is not dangerous right now, but there is concern that it could get worse and endanger him if he isn't treated that day. Or somebody who is walking around looking like he's healthy, but he will be endangered if he doesn't receive a certain treatment on time.
Can you define bisman?
Well, hold on 1 second, just finish the line. Kigon chola sukeres hamekabel insulin, such as a diabetic receiving insulin. So he gives that as a specific example of somebody who needs his treatment on time. So Albert asks the question of, can you define on time? And the answer is yes and no. No, the answer is yes and no. That's the way it is. And a doctor, I think, is likely to give you the same answer of yes and no. There is no doubt an acceptable range of delay for certain tests. In other words, I'm not talking, let's say we're talking about a type 2 diabetic as opposed to a type 1, which I understand is more volatile. You're dealing with a type 2 diabetic who, let's say, if I'm going to make up fact scenarios, I'm going to get into trouble with mistakes, so I apologize in advance. But let's say you're dealing with somebody who recently developed type 2 diabetes and therefore is having tests at various times of day to see the flow of his blood sugar. So if one of his tests is an afternoon test and Shabbos is ending at 5:30, could he go between 5 o'clock and 6 o'clock? Maybe. Could he push it off to say, well, let me wait till after Shabbos is over? It's possible. I would want to turn to the doctor and say, what do you think? Rather than make the assumption that he could wait the half hour.
I would ask the question differently, which is that in type 2 diabetes at certain stages, it's more a question of what the cumulative effect is over a prolonged period of time than the effect specifically today on Shabbat or Yom Tov.
Excellent. So turn to source number 11, please, and then I'll let you resume what you were saying. Rabbi J. David Bleich, in an article on blood sugar tests in the journal Tradition, It's part of his general series of survey of contemporary halachic literature or recent halachic literature. So he writes there, deleterious effects of minor increases of blood sugar are unlikely to become manifest until after the passage of time. However, the nature of diabetes is such that barring a supervening illness or accident, the diabetic's longevity anticipation will be shortened as a result of complications of that disease. The effects of higher than normal blood sugar are cumulative. Medical science has not established a threshold of safety for fluctuation of blood sugar or a time span within which such fluctuation is innocuous. Accordingly, it seems to this writer that any act designed to achieve an optimal blood sugar level for even a minimal period of time is in the category of possible pikuach nefesh, and hence is not only permitted but is mandatory on Shabbat as well as on weekdays.
Except that for seniors, if you are overly tight in your control, you cause harm.
Great.
There's no proven benefit of tight control and type 2 diabetes in the long term any longer.
Right. So I'll refer you back to, I think it's Ramban in Taras HaAdam, who says that the reason why the Torah needs to give permission for doctors to heal is because every treatment involves risk as well, and everything has side effects. And it's up to the doctor to evaluate and say, this is what I believe, based on my knowledge, is best for you, and then it's up to the rabbi to say, okay, let's apply it, you know, in the context of halacha. That's what I would say. But you're right. This cumulative thing is definitely part of this, and I'm very glad I included Rabbi Blank on the sheet.
That's a very Mayhill medical approach.
Okay. Okay.
Because you can, if you would ask, if I were to vote, I would say that would say, you've got a problem. So it's extremely Mayhill.
So it's interesting. When I read this, I thought it was a very strong statement that he was making for a different reason. I thought it was a strong statement because of its ramifications with other illnesses. Once you're going to tell me that allowing blood sugar to get high for a brief period of time is going to affect long-term and therefore violate Shabbos now in order to adjust it, there are a whole host of other diseases that people have. I mean, let's say you have somebody who's running, and now I'm making up medicine, so this, I'm in good territory. But let's say you have somebody who's running a fever of 101. I'm a Fahrenheit guy, sorry. But he's running a fever of 101.
38 and change.
And thank you. And he can, he's uncomfortable, but he's not that uncomfortable. And he says, you know what, I'll wait till after Shabbos. But what if they discover that running a fever like that for a few hours will, long term, have some kind of an effect on his health? Now you're going to tell me that that's also pikuach nefesh. I think you're right, that he's making a very strong statement. That said, he's a far greater Talmid Chacham than I am. And so I'm very comfortable quoting him. But I think that ultimately, and this goes back to my point in the beginning, that this is in Psak, you have to go to your doctor and ask your doctor what the rules are going to be, and you have to go to your rabbi and ask him how to apply it within halacha. And that's what anybody has to work with. So the last bit within this general category is the question of whether I am obligated to minimize my violation of Shabbos. And this is really where the whole shiur comes from. Yeah, I posted on my blog that I was going to be discussing diabetes on Shabbos, and I had a whole host of people email me saying, why is this even a question? There shouldn't be a need for a shiur on it. You simply violate Shabbos and that's it. And the answer is because of what we're about to say. The key question is whether Shabbos is what we call hutra or what we call dichuya. Hutra comes from the word mutar. And what it means is permitted. And the idea is that once we say you're supposed to violate Shabbos in order to save lives, all bets are off. Whatever you need to do, you do. And you do it in whatever way you feel like you want to do it, and you do not minimize anything. Further, if you know you might enter into a situation in which you need to violate Shabbos, you don't need to prepare in advance. Example, you have a woman who is towards the end of her ninth month. She might need to go to the hospital on Shabbos. Is there any imperative for her to try to prepare something in advance? Whether to talk to a non-Jewish neighbor about being able to drive them, or whether to prepare something for a cab, or whether to, whatever example you want to give. Is there any need for her to do any sort of preparation in advance? Well, if I say Shabbos is hutra, that is entirely permitted, then the argument would be, no, you don't need to prepare anything in advance. When the need arises, you do whatever you need to do, however you need to do it, and that's it. That would be hutra. The other approach is dichuya. Lidchot is to push something away. And the idea is that Shabbos is pushed off, but it's still there. And to the extent that we can safely do it, underline bold, italics, to the extent that we can safely do it, we are going to minimize our violation of Shabbos. And therefore we'll make preparations in advance, and therefore we'll try to violate Shabbos, maybe with a shinui in an unusual way. That's the debate. How do I view Shabbos in a life-saving situation? So, to make a long story short, take a look at source number 12, where the Shulchan Aruch discusses one of the primary sources on this issue. The Gemara talks about not getting on a boat within 3 days of Shabbos, or not embarking on a caravan within 3 days of Shabbos. And the Gemara says not to do it. And the question is why? And there are a variety of explanations. But one explanation, which the Shulchan Aruch is going to adopt here, is that when you get on this boat, or when you get into the caravan, you know you're entering into a situation in which you're going to need to violate Shabbos. And therefore, we don't want you to do that before Shabbos. Take a look at source number 12. Hayotzim b'shayara b'midbar, people who get into a caravan in the wilderness, v'akol yodim shem tzrichim l'chal al Shabbos, and everybody knows they're going to need to violate Shabbos. Why? Ki mipnei ha-sakana lo yuchlu l'akev b'midbar b'shabbos levadam. Because what's going to happen to them when it's Shabbos? This is not a kosher tour caravan. This is a caravan of people who want to get where they're going. And so, it's a 7-day trip, or whatever, however long it is, and when Shabbos comes, they're going to keep right on going, and you're going to say, I'm outside the tchum, and there's no Erev, and I'm not traveling, and so on. And they're going to say, okay, so stay over there. And then you're going to be in danger, and say, okay, so what am I going to do? I'm going to stay on the caravan. So you're not allowed to enter the caravan within 3 days of Shabbos, because you know you will be obligated to violate Shabbos.
So the situation you're talking about, more like the situation where you can't do it, etc.
Right. So, right. So potentially, you could construct a caravan case just as easily in which you have to travel and you have to violate. Yeah. Yes. Well, you can, but it won't save you from violating Shabbos. Right. So you take a look at the rest of the line. He says, Gimel yamim kodem Shabbos asurim latzeis. Within 3 days of Shabbos, you may not go. Ubi yom rishon ubisheni ubishlishi mutar latzeis. You're allowed to during the first few days of the week. Why, if I know I'm going to have to violate Shabbos, why is it okay for me to go on Sunday? Why are you allowing me to do it then? So the Mishnah Berurah writes in source number 13, Kvar nisbar hatam mishum deim nikram al shem Shabbos ha'avar. The answer is because the first 3 days of the week are associated with the previous Shabbos. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday are associated with the previous Shabbos. It's only when you hit Wednesday you're preparing for the next one. Ve'ein tzarech liyizayir atar shelo yavo lidei chilul Shabbos haba. You're not obligated to worry about what's happening next Shabbos on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. Why that is so requires its own discussion. This isn't as simple and straightforward as we're making it sound right now. But the upshot is, for the person who's going to need to take a week-long trip, go Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and yes, we know, you're going to end up violating Shabbos. And so he continues to say, "Knesset Hagadola Kasa b'shem Haribal, d'kshiyodeya b'vadei sheyavo lidei chilul Shabbos, asar af b'kiyai gavna v'kaf kasa v'radvaz." But then he says, the Achronim, the later authorities say, if you know for sure, not a maybe, but you know for sure you'll have to violate Shabbos, any day of the week you can't do it. Again, assuming this is a voluntary thing and not something you have to do, as in the case of the diabetic. But the point is, and the reason I'm quoting this is to show you that they're telling you, at least within the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday context, you can't enter into a situation in which you're going to need to violate Shabbos. You are obligated to prepare in advance. And that is a function of saying Shabbos is dichuya, not hutra. Shabbos is pushed off, but it's not entirely permitted. And therefore, if there is a safe way, and I underscore again, if there is a safe way to minimize your violation of Shabbos, that is indeed your obligation. So we're going to get to examples of this at the end, but just briefly, it means that if you have packages with insulin in them, with writing on them say you have to tear the writing in order to get to the insulin, right? So open the package before Shabbos. You know you're going to need the insulin. If you're using a pump, change the batteries before Shabbos to ensure that your batteries aren't going to run out on Shabbos, because changing batteries on Shabbos is a major halachic issue.
And every time I increase, I run the risk of going too low, which means I should be increasing the dose on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and not having an increase on Wednesday, Friday. Here's a plastic.
You're saying not to make modifications which could result in... Right, I hear that. The website JewishDiabetes.com had a very interesting recommendation related to the problem of needing to measure your food and know that what your blood sugar intake is going to be. So they say you should have a Shabbos or Yom Tov meal during the week and measure the effects during the week. And that way you'll be able to plan for Shabbos. They also talk about certain testers. Certain blood glucose testers require extra steps that are actually unnecessary. Other testers don't have. So assuming they're in fact equally efficient, assuming they really work just as well, so you go with the one that will have fewer steps. That's the idea. I should note, in that same article that I quoted before from Rabbi Bleich in source number 11, he quotes a view that says that rabbinic prohibitions are actually hutra on Shabbos. That the rule that Shabbos is only dechuya, and therefore we have to minimize violation, only applies to biblical prohibitions, but that rabbinic ones are entirely permitted on Shabbos. And therefore, if you're going to do something in an unusual way, let's say, you could potentially say that's actually hutra now on Shabbos and doesn't require any minimization. So there is such a view. Whether it's everybody's view or not is unclear. Okay, but that's the general introduction, and what should emerge for us from the general introduction is, in a case of doubt, you violate Shabbos, the diabetes is considered to be life-threatening, and that we generally try to minimize our violation where it would be safe to do so. Those are the three major takeaways from this section. So let's move into practical issues now. Testing blood sugar. So, the first step, and to those of you who were at the shiur I gave a few years ago on injections on Shabbos will remember this, when it comes to preparing the site of a stick, right, preparing, let's say your finger is dirty and you want to clean it before you're going to do an injection or cleaning the vial of insulin. So, in terms of the material that you're going to use, the Tzitz Eliezer of Eliezer Waldenberg recommends that, well, first of all, he writes that when it comes to tearing cotton from a bunch, let's say you have one of these big things of cotton and you're just going to tear off some, so you make sure not to tear a specific amount. You don't want to measure the amount, because tearing to get a specific amount is itself a violation of Shabbos. The Shmir Shabbos Kehilchas says you want to avoid cotton that has absorbed liquid in it. Because that's schita, that would be squeezing it out on Shabbos would be a problem. The recommendation that is made for this, the ideal way to do it, that's brought in the Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, is for somebody to pour liquid on the spot. Let's say you're using alcohol to clean the spot. You pour liquid on the spot first, then you dry it with your cotton, and then you throw out your material. And that's the way that's the easiest way to avoid problems. There are more specifics you can give, but I don't want to get too far into the specifics of anything in particular when there is a clear recommendation. But
why
if anyone,
do you need to dry it?
Sorry?
Why do you need to dry it? It's alcohol. It'll dry itself. You wait 15 seconds.
If you don't need to dry it, that's great. If you don't need to dry it, then don't dry it. I'm dealing with a case where you do need to, but if you don't need to, then you just pour alcohol on the spot and you're done. That's good. What about drawing the blood? So drawing blood on Shabbos is a major halachic problem. There is a prohibition called chovel on Shabbos. There's some debate as to what I am violating with an act of chovel, with an act of drawing blood. I brought you two competing sources. Source number 14, Tosos on the Gemara in Shabbos, takes the view that chovel is under the general heading of netilas neshama, taking a life. meaning that not only is murder taking a life, but taking blood, since hadam hu hanefesh, blood is life, therefore taking blood out of a living creature is called taking a life, and it is prohibited on Shabbos. That's the view of Tosfos. The Rambam Maimonides in source number 15 gave a different source. He said it's under the general heading of dash. Dash is threshing, where you take grain and you smash it such that you break it up to draw out what you want, the kernel from the inside. So that's what you're doing when you take blood out of a blood vessel. The Rambam says that is called dash. So those are the two positions. Generally speaking, we follow the first position, that it's an issue of netilas neshama. There are practical ramifications for this in the laws of Shabbos, specifically when you deal with the... You know what? I'm going to refer you to Rabbi Bleich's article in source number 11 because he discusses it at length. But basically, it affects the question of whether you're allowed to take more blood than you need to take, whether there's any additional prohibition if you draw a larger volume of blood than you needed to. That's where there's a practical application. But there is a prohibition against drawing blood on Shabbos. So what do you do? What am I supposed to do about this prohibition? Once again, as we've said, if a person needs to take blood, they take blood for the purpose of testing and you're done. But there are better ways to do it. The best way to do it is to ask a non-Jew to be the one to do it, because it's not Shabbos for him. There's a prohibition against telling non-Jews to do things for you on Shabbos? Yes, but that's a rabbinic prohibition. Look, if you can tell him before Shabbos, I have this problem where I need to draw blood, so if I stick my finger out, you know what to do. Matov u'manoim, wonderful. But telling the non-Jew to do it is considered to be the best. If that's not possible, then you do it with a shinui. You do it in an unusual way. What in the world is an unusual way to take blood? So here, there are two sources that I wanted to bring that I didn't put on the sheets before I sent them to the Bayit office and they printed them, so you don't have them in front of you, which means that they're on my sheet and therefore all my numbering may be off later when I say it's source number whatever. They'll get confused. But there are two sources that are worth knowing about this. One is from the Igle Tal, Rav Avram Borenstein. The Igle Tal is one of the greatest works as an introduction to the laws of Shabbos, specifically of Malacha on Shabbos, what acts one is not allowed to perform. And the Igle Tal writes that there's a difference between shinui, between a change in procedure regarding Shabbos and other areas of Jewish law. In other areas of Jewish law, when one wants to do something in an unusual way, we require that your change be not only in the Eichut HaPoel, but in the Eichut HaNif'al. And what that means is not only that your deed has to be different, but that your result has to be diminished in some way. When it comes to Shabbos, it is sufficient that you do something in an unusual way, even if your result is a high-quality result. You follow what I'm saying? Even if your result is just as good as the normal way of doing it, that's still called a shinui, writes the Igle Tal, when you're dealing with the laws of Shabbos. The reason is because what's prohibited for Shabbos is what we call malachas machsheves. Malachas machsheves is malacha done with the purpose for which it was done in the Mishkan, when the tabernacle that the Jews had when they were traveling from Egypt into Israel, done with that purpose and with that method. If it's done with a different method, it's already no longer the same malacha that they originally did that was prohibited biblically. That's the Igle Tal's logic. So, for example, to use the case that he brings, let's say someone is a righty. He normally writes with his right hand. You tell him, okay, so on Shabbos, write with your left hand. And he says to you, but you know what? When I write with my left hand, as long as I focus and concentrate, it's perfectly legible. It looks pretty good. Igle Tal says, that's okay. That's still a shinui. You do not need to produce a lesser quality result in order for it to qualify as a shinui. Doctors. Yeah, I was going to make a doctor handwriting joke. Fill in the blank there. Okay. But that's one point. That's the Igle Tal.
Right. Who writes? We use computers.
Well, that's actually the point. That's where I'm going. with this. But that's number one. Number two, a point made by Rabbeinu Nissim, the Ran Shabbos Kuf Gimel Amud Aleph, is that when you do it in an unusual way, you don't have it on your sheet. This is the other source that I didn't put on your sheet. It will be in the digital version that I upload with the audio. You'll be able to get it there. But what the Ran writes is that a shinui doesn't necessarily have to be... Well, no, I'm sorry. Let me word it differently. A shinui should be something people won't do, not just something that people don't do. So, for example, he says, carrying on Shabbos outside of an Eruv. Right? So you'll say, well, I'm a righty, therefore I always carry things in my right hand. So let me just carry it in my left hand, and that will be my shinui. The answer is no. Why? Because people look at carrying with their right and carrying with their left as being the same thing. Unless you're talking about a very heavy item, that's a separate category. But otherwise, realistically, the fact that I pick this up with my right is because that's my natural move. But if my right hand was holding something else, I would pick it up with my left hand without a second thought. If my left hand was closer to it, I would pick it up with my left hand without a second thought. So that doesn't qualify as a shinui. A shinui means something which I normally would not do. Because, let's say, writing with my left hand, it takes concentration in order to make it work. So I'm not going to write with my left hand normally. So those are the two rules that we're going to state as far as shinui. One is a more lenient rule, and the other one is more restrictive. The more lenient rule that we're stating is, your end product does not need to be diminished in any way. However, the restriction that we're making is that in order for it to be a shinui, it has to be something that you normally would not do. You would choose not to do if you had the option. So again, writing with your left hand when you're a righty is an ideal example. So what could be a shinui when it comes to lancing? Well, if you're working with something that has a trigger, for the needle, so you would release the trigger. Let's say I'm told, and this is something I didn't make up, these shinuyim, I got them from books that write about dealing with diabetes. But you release the trigger with the back of your finger, is an example that I saw. Not the finger that's being lanced, but you take the back of your finger in order to release the trigger, squeezing out the blood. Instead of squeezing out the blood by going like this, you press it, let's say, against the tabletop in order to squeeze out the blood. You're pressing against some other surface. It's not the way you normally would do it. Your result is exactly the same. If you're going to tell me someone is weak and he can't do this right now, he needs the blood test, then just take the blood test and don't play games with shinuyim. But if you have the ability to do it, this is a better way for you to go about it. It reduces a biblical prohibition to a rabbinic prohibition. Yeah?
Does the trigger involve any Grumma?
So I believe not. I did look into Grumma a little bit. I don't think Grumma would work as a contention here, because it's a direct result of your action. That's in terms of drawing blood. What about postponing a test for after Shabbos? So we've already addressed this a little bit. Where you can safely delay, the Nishmas Avram, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham says, yes, you ought to delay. If you can safely do so, the doctor says it's no problem, then go ahead and delay it. But here I want to make a special note based on the reading I've been doing about diabetes. When you're dealing with children especially, there's a tendency for the kid to say, do I really have to do this again? And I would be concerned, and I'm saying this personally, I'm not saying this from any source that I've seen, I would be concerned that you educate a child with an improper idea if they see that you're delaying the test. Meaning, if you're dealing with a test for a child, I would want you to make sure to keep the schedule, even if you have the option potentially of waiting, because I don't want the child to get the idea that they can play games with tests and say, well, I'm tired right now, I'm busy right now, whatever it is. They don't always take things seriously when they ought to. Surprise. So for that reason, I think it's important to be very careful about delaying a test, even where you're technically able to do so. You've now drawn the blood. You now have the tester, right? You have the meter. So you're going to put the strip that has the blood on it into the meter. So we try to minimize it. How do you minimize it? The Nishmas Avram in source 18, Rabbi Dr., or source 16 for you. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham says, quoting Rabbi Yeshua Neuvert, who's the author of Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa, he says, if possible, I'm saying it outside of the text in the interest of time, but you can see it there. He says, number one, you do all of this even multiple times. Someone had emailed me a question wanting to know, what about retests? Do those also override Shabbos? The answer is yes. He says, however many times it's needed, you do it, drawing blood and testing it in the machine. But if possible, he says, use a timer to turn on the meter. I thought that was an interesting idea. I don't know how that works, but if it does work, great. And it's battery operated, so I don't know how you would do that. But theoretically, if you have the ability to use a timer, great. If not, you ask a non-Jew to do it, and if that's not possible, you try it in an unusual way. If none of these are options for you, then just do it. That's it. You turn it on yourself.
What about taking the strip out, which turns it off?
So good. I'm going to get to that. Thank you for reminding me of it. But he says, Shlomo Zalman approved of all of this. Another recommendation which I saw, which was interesting, was putting the strip. I'm not dealing now with one that turns on when you put the strip in. But the recommendation to put the strip in the machine when the machine is off before turning it on. And the idea there is, because what kind of machinery, what kind of a changer are you going to use for putting the strip into the thing? Like, it just goes in. So how can you do it in an unusual way? Well, you can't necessarily. Although I have seen some recommended that you insert it partially and then shove the rest in by pressing it against the tabletop or something like that as a machinery, fine. But if you can't, then at least you put it in when the thing is off. Then you haven't done anything wrong. Then, when you're turning it on, you use your shinui to turn it on. In terms of the question of turning it off afterwards by taking the strip out, if you're going to need it at some point on Shabbos, that's 100% fine. It's just like the doctor who hangs up the phone after the call, because another call may come in on Shabbos. If you know this is your last test, so fine. Then don't take it out. Yeah?
Maybe the machines, they turn on when you put the strip in. No on-off button necessarily.
Right. So then this option of putting it in before turning it on obviously doesn't exist. So your best option would be, if it's doable, you put it in partway, not enough to trigger the turning it on. You didn't hit the sensor, whatever it is that's realizing there's a strip there. And then you press it in with the back of your hand or against the tabletop or whatever you're doing. I saw someone recommend with one's teeth. And I thought, with blood on it? Really? All right. Nonetheless, I've seen the recommendation, so I'm just reporting the news.
You have this on the non-bloody
end. I would hope. I would hope. It's just, yeah, you understand why I'm squeamish about this. We have prohibitions against eating blood. One question that was asked is whether it's better to use a battery-operated continuous glucose monitor. One of these machines where you're not actually doing the sticking. So recognizing that you're still going to need to draw blood 2 to 4 times a day to synchronize it, the answer is, for someone who is only drawing blood 2 to 4 times a day as it is, it isn't an improvement. If you're somebody who, if the alternative for you is many sticks over the course of Shabbos, then ostensibly it is better. Yeah, it's a matter of your particular situation and what is it saving you from? That's really what it comes down to. One other testing issue. We mentioned in the beginning that there's this concern for ketones, where if the person's body is not absorbing blood, not absorbing sugar from the blood, then it's going to start to break down ketones, and that potentially can lead to coma. So, testing for ketones is often done with a strip that changes color when exposed to urine. So the concern there would theoretically be Sylvia. You're now dyeing the strip. You're causing the strip to change color. However, this I saw in a piece on the Friends with Diabetes website, and once they said it, it made perfect sense. There's absolutely no problem. Why is there no problem? No, not because it fades. Think about it. If the person doesn't have ketones, what's going to happen to the strip?
Nothing.
Nothing. If the person does have ketones, it's what kind of a situation? Pikuach nefesh. You're saving lives, right? So either it's not pikuach nefesh, but then you did nothing to the strip and you're fine, or you did change the color, but you were supposed to change the color because you're saving lives that way. Therefore, there's nothing wrong. The only thing you should do is make sure that you use a strip that only tests ketones and not glucose. Because otherwise, you're going to end up changing the color for the glucose test, which you didn't need to do. You could use the monitor for that. So that's the only catch, is the issue of using a strip that's ketone specific. But I thought that was it was obvious and brilliant at the same time. Okay.
It's the same thing putting milk into your cup of tea. It's inevitable that you'll change the color of
food. Right, there's a difference though, because when you're changing the color of food, it's called derech achila. That's the way of eating. Changing the color of a strip of paper is different. Good point though. Okay. Delivering insulin. So, delivering insulin, first of all, assembling the needle on Shabbos. And again, there was more about this in this year that I gave on injections. The concern here, if you have a needle that requires assembly, is that this is called makeh bepatish. You are taking two non-usable pieces and you are making them functional. So to make a long story short, it's best to break the needle afterwards. In other words, you assemble it, you use it, and then you break the needle afterwards. Parenthetically, health authorities want you to do that anyway, to avoid the risk that someone's going to reuse the needle. They tell you to break it. But the basic issue here, and what's involved here, is the question of temporary construction. The Chasam Sofer, Rav Moshe Sofer, in Orach Chaim Ayin Beis, says that temporary construction doesn't count as construction anyway. But others disagree with the Chasam Sofer, and if you take a look at the Gemara in Shabbos that I brought you in the source, which is numbered 17 on your sheets, 19 on mine, they give a story about, or they talk about a folding bed on Shabbos, and they tell you that there is indeed a rabbinic prohibition against assembling something temporarily. There's a rabbinic prohibition involved. Now, the truth is there's room to be lenient, because makeh bepatish is usually understood as taking an item and making it more usable. Here you're taking two separate items and putting them together, and that's the point made in source number 20 by Rabbi Eliezer, or 18 on yours, by Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, that there is room for leniency. But the upshot of all of this, I'm jumping a little bit to source number 22 on my sheet, 20 on yours, is that the Nishmas Avram says you're allowed to do this as needed on Shabbos. If you have one that has a needle already attached, that's wonderful. But if not, then you would indeed assemble it, and you simply break it afterwards.
Does putting it into a hazardous waste container constitute breakage?
No, I think we'd want you to actually break it.
That's dangerous.
They actually tell you specifically, the health authorities tell you to break it. They
tell us to break it. They tell us not to break it.
Really?
If that's really interesting. It's dangerous to your health. You cause a needle stick injury.
Well,
you cause us a fake
peacock.
You're
testing yourself. There's no issue with needle stick yourself. I'm not talking about
right. It's your own needle.
Yourself.
You just stabbed yourself with it. I mean, that ship has sailed.
It's a needle stick injury. The testing's a needle stick injury.
Yes, I agree.
Done that. We put it into a viable container, which is a hard plastic, which is a firm craft, which is from which you cannot because it's pretty device.
Right.
So that eventually defines it as being one use. The concept of the Shabbos is one use as well.
Right. I hear. It's an interesting question.
Don't break it, just put it into the box.
Right. I hear the question. I'm not sure. This is definitely a better option than a reusable needle that's going to require sterilization. Sterilizing a needle on Shabbos introduces a whole raft of other problems that you don't want to go into. Okay, what about measuring insulin for injection? Measuring the insulin is 100% fine. The rule is, as I brought you in the source, which is 21 on your sheets, you're allowed to measure for a mitzvah on Shabbos, writes the Shulchan Aruch. The Mishnah Berurah explains that measuring for refuah, measuring for healing, is fine. It's not within the rabbinic decree against measuring on Shabbos. Therefore, you can measure the insulin without a problem. What about making an injection, which is subcutaneous? Is there any concern about subcutaneous injections on Shabbos? The answer is no. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg in his Sitz Eliezer in several different places says there's no issue. The hole that you make closes up. He also notes that someone had written an article saying, well, you know, there's a microscopic wound. To which he said, that's fine, it's microscopic. Therefore, it's not halachically significant. If anyone wants the Tzitz Eliezer references, I'll be glad to give them to you later, but they involve an awful lot of numbers. The Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa makes this recommendation as well, saying there's no biblical prohibition involved in making a subcutaneous injection. And he says the best way to do it, or this is not him now, this is actually a sefer called Refuah on Shabbos. The same idea as we said before, that when you inject insulin, it would be ideal if you could have a non-Jew be the one to do the injection. That would be great if you had that option.
But why would you need to have a non-Jew if there's no prohibition?
Because you could still have a rabbinic prohibition. There's no biblical. Yeah. So it's best to have a non-Jew be the one to do it. If that's not possible, you do it personally. And if you can do it with a shinui, that's great. If you can't do it with a shinui, then you do it directly. If you're using a pump, so you make sure that you check the batteries before Shabbos, as we've said. And if you have to push a button, so again, use the back of your finger to push the button as needed. One other note which came up when we gave our shiur on Kavod HaBrios, we discussed human dignity. What if you have somebody who needs to wear an insulin pump? That's their status, is that they need to wear an insulin pump. And they live in an area where there's no Eruv. So are they going to be stuck indoors all Shabbos long, every Shabbos? So if you're dealing with a domain which is not a biblical Rishus HaRabim, not a biblical public domain, and our area here is not a biblical public domain, the standards are pretty high to reach a bona fide Rishus HaRabim de Oraisa. So if that's so, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg is still strict. He doesn't like it because he says you're wearing the pump at a time that you don't need it. At some point you may need it, but right now you don't. However, Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rav Yeshua Neuwirth, and Rav Elyashiv were all lenient so long as you do the following. Number one, you only load the insulin that you're going to need today. And that means insulin you might need today. It doesn't mean that you're precise in your measure. You have to give yourself a safety margin there. That's number one. Number two, you try to wear it in an unusual way. I don't know exactly what that looks like, because I didn't actually get a chance to see someone wearing an insulin pump a normal way. So I don't know what this actually looks like. But the idea would be to wear it in an unusual way, to make sure that when you're going out, they want you to go out specifically for a mitzvah purpose, like going to shul, going to a shir, something like that. And you don't stop in the road. Because stopping in the road, stopping and starting each time, incurs potentially a new violation. However, the Nitei Gavriel, Rav Gavriel Tzinner, wrote an article on this topic, and he added two points. Number one, he said, exercise is part of treating diabetes. And therefore, he argued that walking around is itself a mitzvah purpose automatically. And further, he argued it's oneg Shabbos, it's your enjoyment of Shabbos. Having someone trapped indoors all Shabbos is miserable. So he argued that this made any walking a mitzvah purpose. And he said in his article that he actually presented this to Rav Eliezer Waldenberg, who had been strict, and Rav Waldenberg conceded the point. So that's very worth noting. If you want to see his article, it's in Hebrew. It's on the Friends with Diabetes website in their spring 1992 Hebrew/Yiddish edition of their pamphlet. It's not in the English, at least not that I saw. Okay, moving on to taking pills. So we're not going to give a whole shiur now on taking pills on Shabbos and the concerns and so on. If someone is in danger, you should take the pill. We're dealing with a type 2 diabetic who needs to stimulate the pancreas. So, if someone is not in danger, the Mishnah Berurah writes, anyway, there is no need for a shinui. It's a source which I have on my sheets as 25, I think you have as 23. Is it on your sheets? Did I include it on yours? The Mishnah Berurah 328.121?
Yeah.
Okay.
22.
Oh, it's 22. Oh, that's right, because one of mine here... But never mind. But it's 22 on your sheets. So the Mishnah Berurah writes that no shinui is required when taking a medicine. His argument is that taking a medicine is not like malacha. Normally, malacha that one does on Shabbos involves a deed that is prohibited from the Torah or something that resembles a deed prohibited in the Torah. In medicine is a separate decree entirely of lest one grind things up. It's not like any of the others. And the proof of it is, he says, if a healthy person wanted to take a medicine, he wouldn't be violating Shabbos. It's only a problem for the person who's actually sick. Now, that doesn't mean healthy people should not take medicine, but that's a separate point. The point is that the Mishnah Berurah writes, there is no need to do something unusual when you take a pill. Rav Moshe Feinstein, in the next source on your sheets, 23 on your sheets, 26 on mine, Rav Moshe Feinstein says, if you can do it in an unusual way, great. But if not, don't worry about it, you take the pill anyway. He's not dealing with diabetes, he was dealing with a case of a person who needed it for stress. That was his case. You can see it on your sheet. Okay. Delivering sugar into the blood. So, would a person be allowed to carry candies outside the Erev on Shabbos in case of need? So, the same caveats apply as what we said before regarding the insulin pump. The only note I would add is that the Nishmas Avram wants you to get inside a house, a building, whatever, before eating. You shouldn't stop outside. But if a person is hypoglycemic, they should take it where they are. They would be wrong for them to try to get indoors first. The other issue that comes up in terms of delivering the sugar into one's system is eating before davening, which is an issue during the week, not just on Shabbos. I brought you in source 24 on your sheets, 27 on mine, the Gemara in Brachos that says one is not allowed to eat before davening. However, the Rambam writes, and it's brought in Shulchan Aruch, that if somebody is ill, and the Rambam defines ill as so ill that he can't concentrate well, right, so that's like all of us. So ill that he can't concentrate well. Then he does eat or drink before davening. Certainly, if a person is in any sort of danger, one should do so. The goal is to be able to daven well. But he's eating before Kiddush. Kiddush is not an obligation until after you've davened Shacharis. There's no Kiddush obligation before you daven Shacharis. So therefore, one who is a diabetic and is concerned he needs to eat should be eating before Shul. This is not a heter for a Kiddush club. He should be eating before shul. Now.
I guess there is a difference. Say, on the normal Shabbos, where the davening may finish at 11 or 11:30, versus, say, Rosh Hashanah, where the davening may not finish till 1:30.
Correct. So he may well need to go out during, and he may well need to make Kiddush, before shofar or whatever. It all depends on what his needs are.
He can eat taka before he goes to shul, knowing that the won't be finished till 1:30.
Yeah. Oh, you're saying the person who can manage on a regular Shabbos but couldn't manage on Rosh Hashanah. Yeah, all of this should be worked out with one's doctor and clear it with the rabbi. But you have to know what your levels are and what your needs are. He may need to test himself to know. I don't know. I mean, the best advice on this, I would tie back to what we said from the Friends with Diabetes website, where they said that you should... by the way, Friends with Diabetes sounds like a funny name until you realize what they're called in Hebrew. Their Hebrew name is Reyim Mitukim, which means sweet friends, right? For the sugar, diabetes, and so on. So, in any case, going back to the point here, though, I'm sorry, the Friends with Diabetes site, when they recommended that you try a Shabbos meal during the week, and then you'll see what the effects are, so I would say the same thing for the person who wants to know what the impact is of going until 11:30 on Shabbos. Let him try it on a Tuesday. See what it's like, see how it goes, and see what his needs are, and then he'll know. Although, as I said in the beginning, your Shabbos diet may throw things off. You know, so it's not 100% analogous unless he has a Shabbos diet on Tuesday, which gets trickier. Okay. Concerns related to Shabbos meals. We're in the home stretch now. So I gave you the reference in the next to last source on your sheet. There are all sorts of guides on the Friends with Diabetes site that are worth seeing regarding the sugar impact of various Shabbos foods. Measuring your food on Shabbos to gauge the impact that you're going to have is fine. We said already that measuring for refuah, measuring for healing on Shabbos is fine. When it comes to Kiddush, so the easiest and simplest way to handle the problem with Kiddush is a twofold problem. Grape juice is sugar, and it gets into your bloodstream very quickly. And then on the other hand, if you have a dry wine with alcohol, alcohol inhibits the liver's ability to release glucose into your bloodstream. So you have problems in both directions. So the best and simplest is, say, here's somebody else make Kiddush. There's no reason you can't be yotze with somebody else. You're under no obligation to drink their wine or their grape juice. And that's easiest. What if that's not an option for you? So there is an option of diluting wine or grape juice with water, and that will reduce its impact. According to the Mishnah Brewer, the last piece that I brought you there, we want to have it at least 1/6 wine, and it should taste like grape. Like, it has to have the grape taste to it. But that's a lot of dilution. Like, you can really minimize the impact that way. Watering down grape juice is not as simple because grape juice often has water in it already. According to the Starkey's Pesach guide from 2 years ago, and I don't believe this has changed, they say no more than 50% water in it in grape juice if you're using grape juice. Another option which may be used, if you're really stuck, imagine you have a room full of diabetics and they need to make kiddush. So there is another option which we normally don't rely on for kiddush, which is to have multiple people drink small amounts and together combine to reach the threshold amount. I mean, the whole thing that you have to drink to fulfill kiddush, remember, is a cheekful. It's a couple of ounces. But if that's really dangerous for people, then okay, so have multiple people drink smaller amounts, and that will combine. It's not ideal within the laws of Shabbos, but again, we're talking about saving lives here. We don't want to endanger somebody for this purpose. When you're dealing with Hamotzi, the Friends with Diabetes website recommends whole wheat matzah. It says that whole wheat matzah has a lower effective carb count and is slower to enter the bloodstream. So that's something worth considering. Last point within this, and then you'll see I gave you this sheet with that summarizes the practical points for you to check with your doctor and your rabbi. But the last point was a question that occurred to me as I was preparing this shiur, and I couldn't find anybody who had written about it, so I wrote to Rav Schechter, and Rav Herschel Schechter gave me an answer. The question is this. We have a mitzvah of shalashudis. Mitzvah is you're supposed to have three meals on Shabbos. The ideal way to do shalashudis is two loaves of bread, just like all the other meals of Shabbos. If you can't have two loaves of bread, then you have mizonos. If you can't do mizonos, then you do... You know, there's a hierarchy running down, but really the Shulchan Aruch wants you to have bread, and worst case scenario, mizonos. Cake, cookies, whatever it is. So the good halachically observant diabetic says, okay, so I'm going to have shalashudis, and I'll have to test myself, and I'll have to have insulin or pills or whatever it is in order to counterbalance the carbohydrates, right? Well, what about a Shabbos like these days, the winter days, right? You finish your meal on Shabbos at whatever it is, 1:30, 2 o'clock, let's say, depending on how long the drasha was in shul and how many friends you have around the table. And frankly, if it wasn't for the mitzvah, you wouldn't be eating at all. Right? You have to eat before sunset, before you go to shul for mincha. So you've got this narrow space of time, or between mincha and marav, whatever it is, you're not really hungry. And for non-diabetics, they're forcing themselves to eat. So now you're dealing with someone who doesn't actually want to eat, has no medical reason to eat, and eating in order to fulfill shalashudis for him is actually going to result in him needing to rely on all of these different heterim, which are perfectly valid and good if you need to eat, but he doesn't want to eat. And for what? In pursuit of shalashudis, which is an odd mitzvah in its own right. Is it deraisa? Is it derabanan? So I asked Rav Schechter the question, what should a diabetic do on a short Shabbos when he wouldn't be eating? Should he force himself to eat shalashudis and therefore do all these other things, or better not to? I couldn't find anybody who had written on the topic. So Rav Schechter's answer was that he should go with what the diabetics call free foods. Free foods, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but free foods are foods which do not require testing of your blood sugar in advance because they have very low calorie and carb content. So free foods include various fruits and vegetables as well as some dairy items. So granted that, the Shulchan Aruch will tell you this is not the optimal way to fulfill shalashudis. It's better to do that, and then you don't run into any trouble. So you use the free foods for the shalashudis. I want to make it very clear, though. When a person wants to eat on Shabbos, the diabetic wants to eat on Shabbos, whether it's his second, third, or seventh meal, if he needs it to prevent himself from being hypoglycemic, or he needs it as part of his enjoyment of Shabbos, then he should eat and do all the things that we described. I'm only talking about the case where he doesn't want to eat, and he has no reason to eat other than Shalosh Shudas, then it's best for him to fulfill Shalosh Shudas with one of the free food options. If you want to know what the free foods are, you can go online. There are lists of free foods on various websites, and the lists tend to be consistent across the various sites that I've seen. Thank you very much. I'll stick around for questions, but I'm going to turn off the recorders.